We'll turn now to number 022162, Leroy Nolan against the United States.
May it please the court. My name is John Younger, and I'm here on behalf of petitioner appellant Leroy Nolan. Mr. Nolan's case is on appeal from the district court's denial of his 2255 motion, which raised Bailey and ineffective assistance of appellate counsel.
Mr. Younger, may I suggest that you might want to raise your voice a bit? That's not terribly good at amplification. It's better at recording.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Nolan's case is on appeal from the district court's denial of his 2255 motion, which raised both Bailey and ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claims. The district court denied Nolan's motion both on the merits and as untimely. Now, as for the untimeliness, Nolan is asking this court to toll the limitations period in 2255, which is appropriate when the cause of the delay is both extraordinary and sufficiently outside of the petitioner's control. Put differently, tolling is applicable if the petitioner's delay was reasonable. Now, Nolan's delay in this case was caused by two reasons. And the first one was that Nolan missed the deadline because he reasonably believed that he could not file a 2255 motion while his Rule 33 motion was pending on appeal. And that belief was reasonable based on cases like Davis and Esposito, which stand for the broad proposition that a court won't entertain a new motion while there's an appeal pending, which, if successful, will afford the movement the relief that he's seeking.
So hadn't we decided that prior to case, which I mean, anyway, we decided before the statute would have run.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
We decided the Rule 33 doesn't cut it off. In other words, you could file. Didn't we decide that prior to the statute?
No, Your Honor. That case that wasn't decided until the O'Connor opinion, which was about a year after Nolan had reasonably relied on the Davis rule. The O'Connor case clearly did hold that the Davis rule must give way when the statute of limitations is implicated.
And see, that's my question for you, because even if we were to agree, and I think we've got a number of cases, Marcello and Taliani, that have said in the proper circumstances, equitable tolling can apply, O'Connor practically uses the term, I think, the clock is ticking. So he knows by 1998 that the clock is ticking, and we know from his letter that gets filed in to Judge Gilbert that this is on his radar screen. He's thinking about it. And so even if we agreed that there was reason to toll until O'Connor, even if you gave him a full year after O'Connor, equitably speaking, he's waited too long, hasn't he? You don't just give people like forever after these rules come out.
I agree, Your Honor, and that comes to the second reason for his delay, which I don't think I made clear enough in the opening brief, and I tried to make that point in the reply in the first two sentences. But the second reason for his delay, sort of ironically, comes out of the O'Connor decision. O'Connor criticized the government for failing to argue that O'Connor's Rule 33 motion, which raised Brady claims exactly like Nolan's, was in fact a 2255, and this court has consistently said since then that when the caption doesn't matter, it's the substance of the motion that counts, and that if there's a motion filed that raises issues cognizable under 2255, that's in fact what the petitioner has filed.
Well, I understand that, but you know, and actually, my personal opinion is many of these habeas rules are about as clear as the forms of action of common law were back around the year 1400. But putting that to one side, it is a common event for people to make a protective filing in the district court who aren't sure whether they're on filing number one or filing number two, or sometimes they'll file with us and ask for permission to file a successive petition, and we may look at it. You can find countless such orders and say, you know what, you haven't even had your first one yet, so we're going to send this, you know, we're going to let you know and let you file in the district court. So you don't see either one of those actions on his part after O'Connor is decided. And, you know, you've got to make a stab at it rather than just say, oh, well, you know, I'm not even going to try in my second or successive because I know I'm not going to meet the criteria.
Well, if I may, Your Honor, I believe based on O'Connor and all the cases that followed, no one reasonably believes that he's already filed his first 2255. So the reasonable thing for him to do is wait until he has an issue that he can raise as a second or successive petition. And that is, in fact, what he did. In 2001, he filed a motion in this court requesting permission to file in the district court. A couple of short months after that, this court decided the Henderson case, in which it decided first that the Rule 33 motion that Nolan and Henderson both filed together was, in fact, a 2255, like Nolan had believed. But it went further and said that because he didn't receive the benefit of the warnings
right.
that this court laid out in Evans, that it wouldn't treat his Rule 33 motion as a 2255.
But why didn't he file his Bailey claim then? Bowsley comes out in 98. That truly is new. I mean, people all came in, actually, and filed these Bailey claims after Bowsley was decided. And he's late on that, too.
Well, that's true, but I think at the time Bowsley came out, no one believed that he had already filed his 2255 because of the mislabeled Rule 33. Bowsley doesn't apply to cases on, for a second or successive petition, as far as I've been able to figure out. So that wouldn't get him there.
It was around 2241. I mean, you know, it's just such a crazy area. But
I understand, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
An additional point that I'd like to make, though, is that throughout the years after the AEDPA has been passed, the courts have struggled, I would say, and petitioners have struggled as well with learning how to deal with multiple post-trial, post-conviction motions, given that there's this deadline. And because of that, the courts had to, create rules, like in the O'Connor case, like in the Evans case, like in Heaven, in Henderson. And part of our argument is just that if any of those rules had been in effect at the time when no one could have used them early on, he could have filed his motion on time. I suppose I would like to move on now to the merits, if I may. As for the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim, I think it can be summarized fairly simply that his appointed counsel on appeal, on direct appeal, failed to raise the most significant and obvious issue that he had, which was the sentencing issue. And that but for counsel's failure to raise that issue, he would have had his sentence vacated and he'd had the opportunity for resentencing on remand. The government doesn't dispute that the issue was significant and obvious. Instead, the government says his counsel may have had a reason not to appeal because the district court only sentenced Nolan to 10% of the, 100% of the drugs that the government was shooting for.
Were there any facts particular to Nolan that could have been introduced on such a remand that might have led the district court to rule differently from the way he did in Henderson's remand?
Yeah, if you mean to speak to the issue of prejudice?
Basically, yeah.
Well, first of all, I would say that what happens on a remand is sort of outside of the analysis for purposes of determining whether appellate counsel was ineffective. What we're looking at there is appellate counsel whose responsibility is to try and seek a favorable result for him on appeal. What happens subsequently in the district court on a remand, I mean, it may not even be the same attorney who's arguing for that.
But that's a practical matter in some cases where they can receive a higher sentence than they that builds into it. I mean, even though it didn't get appealed, I mean, that's the bottom line is if you succeed and we say, no, he should have had that and they should have had the sentencing issue and the sentencing issue decided and we'll send it back and it ends up a greater sentence than you started out with, where we got?
Well, I think that's true, but I think in this case, the facts don't support that belief that the district court on a remand was going to enhance the sentence. But if you look at the record from the sentencing, the district court had a hard time even supporting the 10% amount that the 10% of the amount that the government had argued for. The court said, you know, there was no evidence that there was no evidence of for all practical purposes, the downside of appealing was that the district court was going to find justifications for doing what it had done in the first instance, and in fact, that is what happened. I will go on and argue the... I've run out of time.
Thank you, Mr. Younger. We'll hear now from Mr. Burst.
May it please the court, counsel. I would like to point out that we are now in the 10-year anniversary of the original drug deal that led to the indictment of this case. The original drug deal was in June of 1993. We're now in June of 2003. And the 10-year anniversary of the indictment will be in July of this year. And the reason that we're up here arguing this case on the 10-year anniversary is because the petitioner, Mr. Nolan, allowed so much time to elapse without pressing his rights in this case.
But wouldn't you agree, Mr. Berkman, that it's taken this court a while to work out the wrinkles in the 1996 AEDPA scheme? You know, what are Rule 33 motions? What really is a second or successive appeal? What procedure should the district court use? And on and on. It seems to me that we've had countless cases, and it seems a lot to ask of a prisoner if the 11 judges of the Seventh Circuit are scratching their heads so hard about this statute.
I would agree, Your Honor, that it has taken several decisions, and it has taken a while for the court, this court and the other courts in the nation, to sort that out. But what I would like to point out, however, first of all, is that there is a three-year period where this petitioner is doing absolutely nothing to press his rights one way or the other. Between August 13th of 98, when this court affirmed the district court's denial of his Rule 33 motion, and July 6th of 2001, when he reinitiated the litigation with the requesting the success of 2255, he did absolutely nothing during that time period. Now, obviously, the statute of limitations on 2255 has run. It's run as to the ineffective assistance claim on April 24th of 1997. As far as the Bailey claim, it ran on May 18th of 1999, dating back to when Boosley made Bailey retroactive. So the issue becomes whether or not he can satisfy the standard for equitable tolling.
Of course, actually, just to be picky about it, the standard for second or successive petitions is a rule of constitutional law that the Supreme Court has made retroactive to pending cases on collateral review. What Bowser did was it construed 924C, which we have said was not a constitutional ruling. We have allowed people, in cases like Davenport, to make 2241 claims because 2255 is not an adequate remedy because of this odd set of circumstances. But, I mean, I agree with you that Bowsley at least alerted him to the fact that the Bailey claim wasn't closed because of, you know, whatever happened on direct review or anything like that.
Yes, Your Honor.
But, you know, his argument is that the rules aren't really clear to him until the 2001 decision in Henderson. I guess the question is, why is that wrong?
Yes, Your Honor, I'll address that. As far as his claim that he was waiting on this Henderson decision in 2001, as I understand what he's saying, he thought that his Rule 33 counted as his 2255. And he also thought that district court should have warned him at the time that it was going to count as the Rule 2255 when he filed the Rule 33. And he didn't realize that the Rule 33 wasn't going to count until Henderson came down in August of 2001. Well, the reason that that argument doesn't fly is that the case that decided the issue that a Rule 33 counts as the first 2255 is the Evans decision, which is August of 2000. So if he's really thinking that his Rule 33 counts as a 2255, why doesn't he do anything before Evans comes down? we still have this big time gap of over 2 years where he's doing nothing. So that doesn't make any sense that he's relying on that. To the extent that counsel is arguing that the law is unclear, that is not a grounds for the equitable tolling doctrine. As this court stated in the Marcello case, the petition's argument that the deadline was unclear also makes no sense, because if it was unclear, they should have filed by the earliest possible deadline, not the latest. The deadline was simply missed. This is not grounds for equitable tolling. And I think that was one of the points that one of your honors was making. If it's unclear, then he should have filed. He should have filed. And the decision that said that his Rule 33 counts as a 2255 did not come down until 2000.
Actually, Evan says some Rule 33s count and others don't.
Yes.
It's just another wrinkle in this scheme.
That's correct. And that goes back to your honest point, which is taking some time to sort all this out. In addition, to the extent that Mr. Nolan claims to have been relying upon, or he should have been warned that his Rule 33 was going to count as a 2255, this case is distinguishable from the other cases where that's been talked about by this court, because this court never recharacterized his Rule 33 as a 2255. It simply ruled on it as a Rule 33. So to the extent that Mr. Nolan concluded that his Rule 33 was a Rule 2255, it was not based on the district court's action, and as I've indicated previously, it wasn't based on this court's action either, at least prior to August of 2000. I think one of your honors mentioned the letter that's in the record, and I think that that's significant, because that is really truly the only evidence that we have of what Mr. Nolan was actually thinking during this time period, and whether he was actually relying on this court's decisions. And I think if the court looks at that letter, which counsel has included in his appendix at 162, his letter demonstrates that he really didn't believe his Rule 33 motion counted as his first 2255, because he asked the district court if his Rule 33 motion that was pending extends the time for his 2255. And implicit in that, he's indicating that he thinks he has two separate claims. He just wants to know if one, the time for one, is extended by the other. Finally, Your Honors, I would submit that to the extent that Mr. Nolan indicates he was waiting on the Henderson decision, that's simply belied by the record and the timing sequence. Henderson was decided on August 29th of 2001. Mr. Nolan filed his request for permission for successive 2255 with this court on July 26th of 2001, almost 2 months before Henderson. So therefore, I think it's illogical to say that he was waiting for Henderson in some way. In his reply brief, Mr. Younger indicates, well, that's a successive 2255. Well, and then he went ahead and filed his first 2255 after Henderson. But I think that that misses the point. The point is that prior to Henderson, Mr. Nolan realized that he had grounds for a 2255, whether it be characterized as a first one or a successive. He knew he had the grounds for that prior to the Henderson decision, and still he did not file. As far as when he had the issue, I think Mr. Younger indicated in his opening argument that he was waiting until he had an issue to go ahead and file. Well, he waited much longer than from when he had an issue. He had his issue on the ineffective assistance after the initial affirmance came down in his direct appeal. He had his issue with regard to the Bailey claim, certainly by the time that the Boosley case came down in 1998. So, and then he didn't end up filing his request for successive petition until 2001. So for those reasons, Your Honor, we submit that this petitioner falls far short of meeting the standard for equitable tolling. As far as the ineffective assistance claim is concerned, I'll address that because counsel addressed it briefly. I think it's important to point out here, and I think Judge Keeney was focusing in on that, in the district court, Mr. Nolan's counsel actually prevailed to a certain extent on the sentencing issue of how much drugs should be attributed to this defendant. When the court goes back and looks at the record, you will see that the government's position was that the offense level should be 36 for this defendant, and defense counsel was successful albeit the district court's methodology may have been not the best, defense counsel was successful in getting the offense level down to 32, which is a significant reduction. And as Your Honor indicated, there was a significant chance that on remand, what would happen is that, in going back and looking at this, and when the government goes back and presents additional evidence, which we did, we presented additional evidence that corroborated Bryant Nolan's testimony to a certain extent, there was a significant chance that the sentence could go higher. In fact, if you look at the record and look at the two Henderson decisions, that the one published and the one unpublished, you will see that, in fact, the drug quantity did go higher on remand, albeit not enough to affect the offense level. So there was a significant danger. Mr. Henderson's counsel, in essence, gambled, and he could have lost big, he could have won. He essentially broke even. But on the other hand, Mr. Nolan's counsel simply didn't take that gamble. So, for those reasons, Your Honor, I would respectfully request that the court affirm the decision of the district court denying the 2255.
Thank you, Mr. Fershman. So, your time had expired. The case, therefore, will be taken under advisement.